Hello everyone, welcome to the latest edition of AppForCast. Today is August 6th. Well, welcome. Today is our first music show. I met Macleet Hedero at TED Oxford a couple of weeks ago. As you know, as some of you may know, I was a fellow at TED Oxford. The TED Fellows program is part of TED's attempt to help empower social entrepreneurs around the world doing big things. So Macleet was one of everybody was super interesting, but I really felt a connection with Macleet. We connected on music right away. We had some of the same favorite artists and styles of music. We're both really into Brazilian and Portuguese music. So we just really connected, and I wanted to help expose people to our music because she's just fantastic. There was one night at Oxford where there was a band playing called Scanners. They were a little bit more alt rock, a little bit more eclectic, a little bit electronic. They were really cool. Definitely check out that album, by the way. If I can, I'll try to get them on the show. But after their performance, there were a couple of other musicians in the room. Emmanuel Jai, who gave a brilliant talk at TED, as well as a brilliant performance. And there was also Macleet, who had performed earlier in the conference. She opened up TED University. She opened up the TED Fellows talks. And a lot of people were, a lot of the fellows were just rooting for her to get a spot on the main stage. But that unfortunately didn't happen. But what did happen is, that night at I forget who sponsored this party. It was either IBM or Nokia or something. I can't remember. I'm very sorry. But, anyway, she, took the mic and just, after the show was over, and then, you know, there was sort of like this freestyle session where any, musician in the room just got up and on stage and did their thing. And there was a couple of moments like that with Macleet. And, you know, I'd walk by and she's like, you know, performing with a group of like 20 TEDsters gathered around her, or, you know, she's over in the corner singing to the Bezoses. And, you know, it wasn't her approaching these people saying, "Hey, let me sing." It was always other people grabbing her and saying, you know, "You really have to hear this woman. She's absolutely amazing." So, and you know, I shared that thought. So I wanted to get some of the fellows on the show, and Macleet was one of the first to respond. So I'm really, really glad about that. So Macleet's mission is all about making the arts the core of the dialogue between different peoples, different cultures, different countries, different disciplines. So she was like the perfect TEDster. So one of her largest undertakings is, she's organizing a trip for around 15 expatriated Ethiopians, to return to Ethiopia this year for an annual music festival and to interact with the culture there. And this is a Ethiopian organized music festival that occurs every year. And what she's doing is bringing, this creative diaspora back to Ethiopia to experience this annual event. And, I just wanted to give her some time to talk about it. So first I'm going to play one of her songs, then I'm going to go into an interview with her. So I really thank you for listening to the show again. And, Macleet Hedero.
Be gentle with me. I feel a fragile oh this year. Be gentle with me and the boys, the walls. I count 10,000 walls around my heart now. I walk amongst them in the down from on top of them. I walk amongst them, in between them, shout from on top of my.
We're just listening to Macleet Hedero's song Walls off her album Eight Songs. I love that song. You can pick up her album Eight Songs off cdbaby.com. You can also check out ilike.com or lastfm.com or YouTube. And on all three of those sites, just search for Macleet Hedero. That's MekleetHedero. And, so now I'm just gonna, let you eavesdrop a bit on a phone conversation that she and I had, earlier today. So, I didn't catch the beginning of the conversation because I was trying to figure out how to record a phone call. They make it extremely difficult on the iPhone. So I had to actually use my, Nokia N96, which I got from Ted. That was not a plug. I really did use it. Because it was just easier and, it allowed to do the call, but I was actually trying to figure it out as we were talking. So, here is Macleet.
It was good. I totally had a little dip in energy. Just, I went from, you know, how intensive Ted was to, a space where I was, just kind of, I was doing a lot of work, but I was kind of mostly just me and my computer. So it was just such a shockingly opposite environment, you know, going from that hyper social to just doing a lot of writing. But actually the work went really well, and I stayed with the founder of the festival, who lives in Oxford.
That's pretty awesome. The Thousand Stars thing, which I learned about a couple of weeks ago at TED. Oh, and just so you know, I'm recording already.
Yes, I figured.
And I think it's pretty awesome. It's you and how many people? How many Ethiopian diaspora are coming to Ethiopia?
There are 15 of us, and we're really from all different creative disciplines. There's poets and photographers, filmmakers, one theater director, one actor, and then musicians, singers, and MCs. So we're all going to the Thousand Stars Festival in December. And the festival, so should I be explaining, like?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, sorry. So The Thousand Stars Festival brings together 56 ethnic groups from the southern regions of Ethiopia. It's basically 3 days of music and dancing. And it happens in the city of Arba Minch, which is where we got our name. The name is the Arba Minch Collective. So we're going to observe, to participate, to document, and also to make new creative work based on the experiences that we have while we're over there.
So is the goal more to, as like a creative inspiration for the people going, or is it trying to jumpstart some sort of creative movement there, or what's your ultimate purpose?
So I see there's kind of two things going on that are focused on both sort of sides of on both locations. What in terms of what's going on in Ethiopia, I think our purpose of being there is first of all to really begin to these 56 groups are coming together, and they are and they've been coming together for 7 years. So this is the seventh year of the festival, and we're working with the founders of the festival to kind of bring more international attention to what's going on in this region, and in a way to diversify what people think of when they think of Ethiopia. Like particularly, you know, back in the 60s when there was still a lot of decolonization going on around Africa, Ethiopia's reputation, when people thought about Ethiopia, they thought about Haile Selassie, and they thought about they thought about a country that was sovereign. And even that's not the whole story of Ethiopia. But then once 1984-85 came around, and the famines happened and Live Aid happened, and there was this incredible, overwhelming image of Ethiopia that went out to the world of a country that was starving. And so that became...
Yeah, and that's like all our generation knows.
That's all our generation knows, to the point where when I was growing up, you know, in New York in 1986, right, and I would meet kids and they would say, "Oh, what kind of name is that? Where are you from?" And I'd say, "I'm from Ethiopia." And they would say, "Oh, is your family starving?" And it was very casual. It wasn't like these were kids, but that's what their association was. And those kids are now my age, and that's what people see. And so we want to really impact the international image of what Ethiopia is. In the sense of it's really so many things, and it's actually a real place with real people living real lives, and it comes back to that idea of multiple stories that Chimamanda Adichie was talking about at TED, and really.
Yeah, I was just going to bring that up. I think she really touched on a point for a lot of us there. I mean, Africa was sort of represented pretty well. There was people from all over the continent, and I think at least with me that resonated a lot.
Definitely. And I feel like what's really cool about what she said, and, you know, in terms of what we're trying to do, but then also just in terms of what I see, it's like when I'm talking to young Africans, whether they're European, whether they're living in European diaspora or North American diaspora, whether they're actually living in Africa, there seems to be a shift going on where people are ready for a different understanding of Africa in the world, and I feel I feel like it's coming. And there's all kinds of different ways that people are working on it. I feel like you're working on it in terms of technology and entrepreneurship, and I'm kind of working on it from the culture side of things.
Yeah, and it's all really important. I think. one of the things that the industry has under, like the sort of so-called aid industry or, you know, the NGO industry or whatever, has ignored for a long time is the power of the, or I shouldn't say ignored, maybe overlooked for a long time, is the power of the diaspora to help itself and to, you know, get things started, and then maybe there's a place for them to help. But, you know, it's become a sort of like, hey, we're going to do all this stuff for you, and it should fix all your problems.
Right. And it becomes a really weird relationship, too, to aid, in the sense of, in many countries, the aid organizations are the ones with money. But then then people who are in aid organizations feel like they don't have any money because in the sort of context of, you know, Western countries, they're always grant writing and there's a sense of being constantly searching for funding. And so, but it's a very weird, it creates a real imbalance in how aid people see themselves and how people on the ground, I mean, I can only speak for Ethiopia, but aid. So it's a complicated relationship, for sure.
One of the things I've noticed here in Uganda is there seems to be almost, for an organization like mine, which is Ugandan, you know, it was founded here, organized here, it's private sector, everything, we end up in spaces where we're sometimes competing with aid organizations for contracts from, you know, even the local government. Like if they want something built, they might go to the aid organizations instead of going to like their own local software developers, which is unfortunate, but, you know, it's one of the things that groups, at least groups like mine, have to work to change, and, you know, other groups have to work in wherever they are to sort of change that perception that, hey, look in your own backyard.
And I think there will be a kind of critical mass shift in that kind of area as it grows and as the kind of local knowledge gets prioritized over time. I agree with you. I think it's incredibly important. I think one thing particularly about the kind of cultural sector in which I'm working is that it's like the resource of culture to be able to bring real strength to people is so clear. In a sense, the work I'm doing is not about building something new. It's actually about working to strengthen the value on this incredible resource that's actually been there always and always.
Right. Hold on just one second. Let me save the conversation before my computer crashes. Okay. I wasn't ending it. I like to save like at various points just in case something goes wrong. I don't want to lose everything.
Oh, totally. I totally understand.
So, did I cut you off mid-thought, or were you finished with that?
Well, I guess what I was going to say, what I was going to go to was just kind of the other side of the work, which is what happens in North America on the diaspora side. And I think, because there's what's happening in Ethiopia and then what's happening with Ethiopian Americans and Ethiopian Canadians. And I think it's, you know, in that sense, we're trying to create a stronger feedback loop so that really young people can have more connection to what happens, what's going on culturally in Ethiopia. And at this point, we're definitely wanting this idea to live on past this 1 year, but we're not yet exactly sure how it might work. In other words, we may become the first cohort of the Arba Munch Collective, and then young
right.
diaspora folks every year would go as a group. Or we may create some kind of structure for that to happen, and then maybe the Arba Munch Collective becomes an ongoing creative collaboration between this particular group of people, even though we would set something else up for the continuation of the cycle. But the idea there is that I'm really interested in galvanizing a generation of artists in diaspora, because particularly as there's just this enormous growth in immigration from East Africa to North America. And I think what's happening
yeah.
now is there's a kind of maturity of voice that's beginning to come about. People who are artists in the diaspora, there's a kind of self-awareness of a generation coming, and I think that voice needs to be in an international sphere with other diaspora groups from immigrants from all over the world. And so, on the North American side of things, I'm trying to develop that voice and strengthen it as a meme, as an idea that has
right.
has force internationally.
Interesting. I just want to switch notes a bit and
yeah.
talk about your music, just because you're a brilliant musician, and I really enjoyed. I've been listening to 8 songs a lot since TED, and I just wanted to, talk to you about, your inspiration and, maybe some of your influences and, just let you sort of kick it for a bit about the stuff that you do.
Yeah. My music has taken on kind of many different shapes. The 8 Songs Project, which is my solo music, it's the music that I write on my own, it's been developing since about 2006. And I actually have a new album coming out that is based on that's in that line, but it's much more developed than 8 Songs. I have, full instrumentation, guitar, and upright bass and cello and trumpet, saxophone, bass clarinet, viola, and percussion.
Wow. So it's like a full band, full
yeah,
ensemble.
Yeah, fully orchestrated and really, really rich instrumentation. But that music has been developing. My influences are really, really varied and diverse. In terms of songwriting, I love Stevie Wonder mm-hmm. and Bob Dylan and Leonard Cohen. And in terms of kind of like intensity of delivery, I love Nina Simone and how it's her.
Yeah.
It's just her. The world does not enter when she sings, It's a kind of
right.
intensity that's so rare and really, really difficult, actually, to achieve. And I love Virginia Rodriguez, who's a Brazilian singer who has these kind of soaring tones that I got a lot from. And Lila Downs, who's a Mexican singer, who has she really goes for multiple tones, and I love flexibility. I can't be one of those singers who just does one thing. And on that tone, I actually learned a lot from Duke Ellington. I went to a series of lectures about Duke Ellington about a year ago, and from Marcus Shelby, who is an incredible bassist, and really is a staple of the San Francisco jazz world. And he did a series of lectures on Duke Ellington and talked about how Duke Ellington approached different instruments and different voices and wrote particularly for different instruments and used their tones to tell story. And I got a lot from that, both in terms of songwriting, but also in terms of vocal tone. That was a real inspirational musical moment. I listen to a lot of jazz. I love working with jazz musicians. I work primarily with jazz musicians because they're so subtle and can move with an audience and a mood and a moment, and that's so important. You know, it's different than reading from a page. They're trained to connect and work from connection, and that's really important.
Negrumi da noite, ureluzi utia, o perfil azevis, que a negritude criou. Negrumi da noite, ureluzi utia, o perfil azevis, que a negritude criou. Constitui um universo de beleza explorado pela raça negra. Por isso um negro lutou e acabou, em vez de se consagrou. Por isso um negro lutou e acabou, em vez de se consagrou. Ilê, oh rei, tu és o senhor dessa grande nação. E aos negros clamam, abençoa, abençoa, abençoa. Ilê, oh rei, tu és o senhor dessa grande nação. E aos negros clamam, abençoa, abençoa, abençoa. O de comarote, o te arere, o te comarote, o te e, o te arere. O de comarote, o te arere, o te comarote, o te e, o te arere.
You have been listening to Maclete Hedero, and that was her rendition of a popular Brazilian song off her album Eight Songs. And now back to the interview.
Do you want to talk any about the Red Poppy Art House?
Yeah. So the Red Poppy Art House is a small space at the corner of 23rd and Folsom Street in the Mission District. And when I say small, I really mean small. It's 650 square feet, and that includes the bathroom. And it has two long walls that are always filled with large-scale paintings, and primarily they're paintings in progress because it's a working artist studio. So it has the feeling of a space where work is made. It has a little counter where, and it's not a kitchen, but it's kind of it has a stove, and we cook meals there. And there's a piano and an upright bass and a little loft. And it's not really a collective, but it is a hub. It's a place for artists to find each other and to collaborate and to build based on those collaborations. It's very much situated in the Mission District of San Francisco.
Huh.
Both doors are open. Well, you, it's on a corner, and there are two doors that are often open to the street.
Okay.
And there's a kind of circularity that happens where people wander in. And what's nice about it is they wander in and they don't quite know what it is because they've never seen a space that's both a working studio and a performance space and a space for families to create and make work. On the weekends, there's a family art program where we paint with kids from the neighborhood every Saturday for 3 years, 3.5 years. And every Friday and Saturday night, there's performances with music from all over the world, really top musicians from all over the Bay Area. And it's funny because it's so small, and you wonder, well, why would such fantastic musicians come to play in a space that's so small?
Right.
And what you realize is that there aren't a lot of spaces for musicians to truly be able to interact intimately with an audience.
Hmm.
The audience, the front row is literally 4 feet away from the musicians. And what happens is that because the exchange is so real, because you can look in people's eyes and feel it when there's a swell in the audience, or hear it when there's a gasp of delight or a laugh, what happens is that the loop between audience and performer becomes really strengthened. And a lot of the musicians who play there say, despite maybe playing it at a much larger venue, the Poppy is actually their favorite place to play. And people tell us that they play better there because of what happens.
Because of the
interaction. And I think what it is that it's closer to how music is made in most places around the world.
Right.
And it's very different than, say, a theater that's empty during the day, that's full function, is only completed during maybe 4 hours of the week. Say they have two performances in the week. Maybe for 6 hours in the week the space is filled, and for the rest of the time it's empty. And that means that when a musician comes in there, they literally have to warm up the room, because the room has been probably literally cold
right.
the entire week. But at the Poppy, there's a life there. It's a space that lives. And so when you come in, you're also feeding off of that constant sense of being alive in the arts that we're trying to make every day, all day there.
That's cool.
So I'm a resident artist there, which means that I use the space as my primary creative home. I use it to write music, to rehearse. And it's also a place where, as a resident artist, I may just have a dinner. You know, I may be like, you know, today I'm going to invite over a bunch of poets or
right,
something.
Right.
You know, it can be anything. But the point is that creative energy is a fluid thing, and it doesn't stop with making work. It's actually alive in everything that we do. And the more you concentrate it in a place, the more when you go to that place, it's returned to you. It lights up. And then the other thing I wanted to say about the Poppy is that the way that it's situated in the neighborhood is really important, too. Most of the block of the Poppy is a school, Cesar Chavez Elementary School, with a gorgeous, enormous mural covering it. We're right across the street from a children's park, which means that families are constantly going past the Poppy on their way to the park, and so it's an energy of people walking, and there are always kids around. So even the street has a sense of that sparkle of living energy that happens. And so it's a really important thing that also it's not on a commercial strip. It's in a residential part of the Mission, in the sense that people have the feeling that they have to, in order to experience the arts, they have to go to a museum or they have to go to a theater. But the Poppy is really trying to say, this is your everyday.
Right.
It's part of your part of your everyday. And so we're in a space that people interact with at an everyday level. We call it our mom and pop corner art house, you know, like the bodega that you go to buy milk,
right.
You know, it's like the poppy stop in for your
your quick music fix.
Yeah.
How do you feel about the way the music industry is right now? There's a lot of stuff changing. You know, some artists think it's really great that you have, you know, this new direct outlet to your audience via the internet,
yeah,
and things like MySpace and Spotify and all this other stuff. I mean, but other people, especially like the people who've been in it a long time, like the big artists, they sort of see like their revenue declining and their CD sales sliding, and they seem to be really bitter about the industry and the effect the internet's having on it. So I'm just wondering, as an independent artist, where do you fall on that line?
As an independent artist, it's pretty good for me. I think how things have been changing. It's incredibly democratizing to not have to go through the huge record bureaucracy or those few companies that determine your success, or if you weren't with them, there was no other option. So I think it's been really important to give music a wider voice, because the reality is a lot of people make music.
Right.
And there's no reason why they shouldn't be able to do that. I understand how artists should be able to make a living from their music, and without CD sales, that can be difficult. But I also think what's interesting about it is that it's returning live performance,
right,
to kind of a more central place. Because, you know, personally for me,
mm-hmm,
you should be better live.
Right.
You really should be. If you're not better live than on your CD, there's a real problem. unless you're an artist for whom the art is the studio.
Right, right.
And there
right.
are a lot of artists like
well,
that.
Like
so,
electronic
so
artists
I don't,
and, you know, really heavy rock stuff. But
right. There's that, and I appreciate that. I can appreciate that,
yeah,
as the art part of it too. But I do like the fact that live performance and touring is becoming that's becoming how people are making revenue, and I think that's important. I think they should be making revenue from that. I'm sort of a person who straddles worlds a little bit, because I'm not a musician who is primarily making their living from CD sales and performing. I'm also involved on the level of in the kind of broader world of the arts, arts institutions, museums. I do a lot of work with those kinds of spaces to get myself commissions to write music.
Right.
And that's kind of how I see myself being able to sustain.
So,
and it's a whole different arena.
And I think that's really cool that, I didn't know that, but I think it's really cool that you bring it up, because what I see happening is so before you could make music just from, like, you know, putting out your album, your 8-track CD, however it evolved over time. But now I see people having to sort of adapt. And it's not, you know,
right.
some musicians won't just make money off their album or whatever they put out in the world. But, you know, like in your case, you found sort of this hybrid space where you're working in the art field and you're having the art field, you know, commission work from you as a musician, and, you know, that is setting up your career as a brilliant, you know, singer, whereas other people are doing different stuff. It seems like it would be really exciting to sort of be able to think outside of the box right now, instead of in the traditional, you know, A&R manager and, you know, take the loan from the record label type deal.
Exactly. And I think that any transition means that you have to be more creative about how you make it work. And that's the real opportunity, to be able to kind of pioneer new models. It's like, okay, something's falling apart. Well, how else can we do it? And how can we do it in a way that doesn't feel exploitative? Because the other side of the record labels was that a lot of people felt exploited, and a lot of people ended up with bad contracts,
right,
and actually not making money from their music. So I think we have an opportunity also to change that value,
right,
and not put artists in that position. People are getting creative also in terms of like I just got myself fiscal sponsorship.
Uh-huh.
Right? So I'm fiscally sponsored by an organization called Fractured Atlas, which is based in New York.
Okay.
And they sponsor 1,000 artist projects all over the country. And they give you all kinds of resources in terms of information and being able to figure out how you can make it work as an artist. So there's also these other organizations that are coming up to allow you to be more creative and more broad-minded in how you structure your career.
Interesting. So real quick, the last thing I wanted to touch on, earlier you were talking about jazz, and there seems to be like this reawakening among like people of our generation related to jazz. Like, I've been listening to the CD from this girl named Esperanza Spalding.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah, she's awesome.
I really like it. Yeah, and she's really young. She's like 21, I think.
Really?
And,
I didn't know that.
There's you, and there's... Yeah, she's really young. There's I don't know, I just see sort of like this rebirth of jazz.
I think that, you know, it's hard for me to speak on an international level about that, because my experience has really been in San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
And I would say there are a lot of young jazz musicians in San Francisco, people who are, you know, fully immersed in the culture of jazz, the history of jazz, and who are jazz musicians. On the other hand, I also have an experience of being a venue that is very dedicated to jazz, because the Red Poppy Art House, we're you know, consistently featuring jazz music and wanting to give jazz musicians a place to play. And honestly, it's also not easy to find an audience for jazz. The audience is not guaranteed.
Right.
Say the way, you know, it can be hard to have an audience for jazz. So I do think there's a resurgence in the interest in playing the music, but I'm not sure there's as much a resurgence in the going out to see that particular music. And I would love to see that change. I also think that, you know, when it comes to the resurgence in people listening to jazz, I think it's also a resurgence in terms of the classics, Ellington, Miles Davis, you know, the jazz singers, Billie Holiday.
Right.
I think those artists who are in the jazz canon are very much listened to by younger people. But I'm not sure that a lot of people are listening to new jazz that's being made by young artists.
Right.
I think Esperanza Spalding also is, she does a lot of different, I don't necessarily want to use the word fusion, but she does a lot of like soul, neo-soul.
Right, right.
Which is more popular and accessible. I would love to see a resurgence in appreciation for jazz, because I just think, I just love it, and it was some of the first music to there was the music I loved as a child, but then as I grew into like what my own kind of taste and love was, jazz was right up there. Really introduced to me by my sister.
Oh, cool. Well, thank you. I really appreciate you doing this, and hopefully, you know, it helps expose a few more people to you. And if there's anything that I know you said you had a new album coming out.
I do, yeah. Porto Franco Records.
Okay.
And it'll be out in January of 2010.
With no lover, like a beauty eyes no see, like a wooden box of pictures underneath a golden tree, like a single silver.
So I'm going to close the show with the appropriately titled At the End of a Long Day by Maclete Hedero. I really want to thank her for participating in the podcast. Please pick up her album, 8 Songs, and you can find out more information about her forthcoming gigs and her new album at MacleteHedero.com. I'd like to thank our newest sponsor, CityAlly.com, CITIALLY. .com, which is a professional network with a primary focus on Africa and the Middle East. So please visit their site. I'd also like to thank the people from DrupalCon Paris who've been sponsoring us for several months now, leading up to DrupalCon Paris in September. And I'd like to thank Maclete for allowing us to use her music and participating in this interview for the show. Thanks once again, and catch us next time on AfriCast.
Oh, kindle me a fire where you could use my bones, and one day, someday, leave red and will drink the heat.